Hey everyone, how's it going? Welcome to the Know Your Gear podcast live, episode 331. Advice, please. Idea of a humbucker replace a Fender HSS. You know, this is always tough, right? These big questions like that, like what pickup would you put in this guitar? What amp would you buy? And then there's no other information. So I try to come at these a certain way instead of saying like, hey, without all that information, I can't give you a suggestion, but I can give you suggestions. I really think pickups, when it comes to pickups and guitars, like I said, I really think most players really like a PAF sounding pickup. And here's why I say that, okay? There is so much music that was written on certain guitars and certain pickups. And so to me, when you think of the history of music, rock and roll music, blues music, jazz music, you name it, there is a huge amount of music that was written on guitars that had either P90s, single coil pickups, or humbuckers. Obviously, those are three options, but there's more to it than that. And you got to understand that the PAF really started as they wanted to make a hum-canceling version of a P90. They wanted the P90, but they didn't want the 60-cycle hum. So the PAF was really to try to kind of capture what the P90 was doing. There wasn't an unhappiness with the PAF, the P90 sound. It was more about the noise, the 60-cycle hum. So a lot of players, believe it or not, they really do like PAFs. It's kind of like recommending, like, what's a good first overdrive pedal? And you go, oh, a Tube Screamer, because it's a pedal. Not only does most everybody has one, most everybody's tried one, but significantly, it's been used in so much music. And it universally works in so many situations. And so a lot of times when people talk about Strats, I think of the PAF style pickup. And I say style because it doesn't matter who, right? Everybody's using kind of their different, it's like, for lack of a better analogy, a chili recipe, right? There's so many different kinds of chili, but there's everybody's recipe is just a little bit different, right? Whether you have beans and no beans, whether you have it spicy, not so spicy. Same thing with pickups. It's essentially, it's just an all around good pickup. So a PAF style pickup is a good place to start as a good style of pickup to put in a Strat, especially in the humbucker, in the bridge position of a Strat. I also am really, really a big fan of the Seymour Duncan JB in the bridge. And I always love it because you're always going to get somebody going, oh, I hate that pickup. I don't know why. It's just one of those pickups. I could say PAF and most players say nothing, but JB, they're like, there's always this, and I think it's, and you know, I think more so than somebody doesn't like it, I think more so JB is just so commonly used. And it's because it does a really cool thing. It does like this fat, throaty PAF thing, but just a little bit more push. And it works really well with single coils. So that's something I would suggest as well. And then, of course, this is back to my best advice now. That's just a suggestion for a pickup. When you have your humbucker single Strat, what I would suggest to you is to figure out what you don't like about it. That's kind of what people don't really focus on, especially guitar players. They're just like, I don't like it. I want to upgrade it. And I'm like, well, what about it specifically don't you like? Because that will send you down the right kind of path to finding the fix for it. Like, it's too bright. It's too muddy. It's too, usually, if you don't like a sound, it's because it's either too much of something you don't like or not enough of something you do like. So try to figure that out and I'll kind of hone you down the right road. I hope that kind of starts you down the right road. And again, and for those that hate like JBs and P90s and stuff, that's great too. That just means you have a different kind of, you're going after a different sound, or you have an ear that hears a different, you have different things you're trying to get out of it. SurfB says, I like the Seymour Duncan full shred. No one likes it. I like that pickup. But again, I don't know if no one likes it. I personally think a lot of pickups suffer bad naming. I've said this before. The Paul Reed Smith makes a pickup called the Metal or something like that, right? Metal. It's the worst name. It's the most non-metal pickup. I wouldn't put it in any of the aggressive pickup categories. The full shred, same thing. I think it was, a lot of those pickups to me are signs of the times, right? They were like, people like the shred. This one's called the full shred. People like distortion. This one's called choke you with distortion. So there was a little bit of that time. Right. Same with pickups that are just have the name blues in them. I don't think it's a good idea to name any pickup with a style of music or a style of tone. I don't think it's a great marketing idea, other than for that one time. So Larry wants to know who loves Lay Sensors. I like Lay Sensors. They're a pickup I always go back to. I told you I have a love-hate relationship with Lay Sensors. I don't know what it is. That's why I said I always kind of feel like I have to have a set because there's something about them I love, and then I get like I'm not in the mood for it, and that's what it is. I'm just not in the mood for it. Okay. Let's see. We have more questions. Let me grab some early questions right now. The first question I saw was from Chris this week, who says, can you explain how you would EQ a pickup with it just being copper wire and magnets? Thanks. Love for spending my Fridays here. You know, these are those questions you guys want, generally speaking, especially with pickups, everybody wants these easy plug and play answers that just solves all things. Pickups are way more complicated than people give them credit for, and not in the way that they're put together, but in the insane amount of combinations they can be put together. And I've really worked really hard over the years to kind of find ways, and that's why, if you guys know, I've been doing more of these YouTube shorts and these on Instagram and stuff, and they seem to be doing really well, where I'm just tackling questions like this, and it's really tough to do answer a question in 30 to 60 seconds. It's crazy. But let me give you a great way of explaining a guitar pickup and what wire and a magnet can do to a pickup. Now, this is just for illustration. It's like Doc Brown, right? This is not to scale, for illustration purposes only, but I want you to understand that it can, how something can work, okay? I want you, for the sake of, and this is going to be easy, I promise, for the sake of understanding, I want you to think of a magnet on a pickup as sugar. That's it. Just think of sugar, right? Everybody's probably had some sugar. And I want you to think of the wire as ghost peppers. Just think of a hot pepper, right? If you have one of those crazy, like, I can't wait to be on hot ones, and you don't think the ghost pepper's hot enough, then you can go hotter. If you think a jalapeno is hot enough for you, then it's a jalapeno. Just think of a really spicy pepper. Now, if I was to make something and put some sugar in it, you would tell me it was sweet. But I could add some ghost peppers to it, and at some point, it being sweet won't matter because it's burning your mouth. You're like, this is spicy. I'm like, yeah, and sweet. And I'm like, no, just spicy, man. And I'm like, no, there's a lot of sugar in there. And you're like, no, it's just spicy. So that's kind of how the combination. So when somebody says to me that question, his question is, you know, how can you EQ a pickup? How can you, with wire and magnets? Well, that's exactly how you do it. You got to think about what they're doing. They're adding and subtracting things. More wire is more resistance. It's more length for the signal to go through. So it can in turn restrict the high frequencies. So you could have a pickup that is really overwhelmed and not producing a lot of high frequencies. If that's all it was just sugar. Right? Oh, wait, in this analogy, I'm sorry, it's pepper, right? Just the peppers. It's just spicy, okay? But if I add a magnet, especially a strong magnet, so I'll use a P90 is a great, great way to explain it. A P90 is not a complicated pickup. Believe it or not, I think it's the least complicated pickup to understand and make as your first pickup because its anatomy was so straightforward when it was created. If you want to make a good P90 bridge pickup, you would get yourself some plain enamel wire and you would wind it 10,000 times around a Alnico 3 magnet, okay? So this is, like I said, think of what we're cooking today, right? This is a cooking show now. I'm giving you cooking recipe. I'm giving you the recipe. Three spoons sugar, right? One spoon, whatever, pepper, right? Just whatever. This is the ingredients. You take the P90 shell, and you're going to put plain enamel wire 10,000 times, wrapping it, okay? For the most part, okay? In other words, there's a little bit of variance there. And you're going to put an Alnico 3 magnet, which will have a gauss of, and you're going to gauss it, in other words, make it magnetized, gauss 25. So that's essentially it. So if you think of the most iconic P90s back in the day, you think of Alnico 3 magnet, 25 gauss, 10,000 turns of plain enamel wire. Super easy. A neck pickup for a P90 essentially will be 9,000 turns of that plane enamel water. Now, here's what's funny. That's an ingredients, okay? You could make that. Now, what's going to happen is if I was to change that Alnico 3 magnet to Alnico 5, the first thing I would want to do is not get the magnetic, get it gauze at 25. I'd want it more like 20 because it's going to be too strong. The magnet's going to be too strong. It's going to change things too much. To me, it's going to make the pickup sound a little brighter and a little bit more aggressive, just a little bit, and more clarity. That's what's going to do. This, I know this is hard to visualize, and it's really hard to say in... Oh, and Fast Freddy said, what gauge wire? 42-gauge wire. I'm sorry, I should have said that, but P90, 42-gauge of plain enamel wire, 10,000 wraps on Alnico 3 magnet, gauze at 25. That is your quintessential P90 pickup that most people are going to have experienced. The reason I say it like that is it's not important you know that. That's the ingredients. That's the recipe. Now, like I said with the earlier analogy of the recipe, if I add more pepper, if I add more sugar, then it's no different than if I take away and add things with that magnet. Essentially, things will be slightly different. You could argue that this is just a little bit spicier. This is just a little bit sweeter, and I really don't even notice it. That's true, but it is a change in the recipe. And you do have to change the recipe quite a bit for people to notice a difference. And that's the problem with pickups, so you know, is that people who get into pickups really get into the subtleties of like, just a little sweeter, just a little spicier, just a little bit more. And they love that. They love the nuances of that. And some people go, I don't even taste the difference. And if you're that person, that's fine. There's no wrong answer here. It's just that's how simple and silly it can be when you're talking about those small changes. So in the grand scheme, like when somebody says, you know, how can you really change things with just some wire and magnets? You can. It's just not huge. You know, like I said, if we change the wire to a smaller wire, 43-gauge, 44-gauge, if we change the magnets to ceramic, if we change the magnets to Alnico 8 for some reason, you know what I mean? There's just things that we can change, but the differences are small, and it's hard to argue that. So kind of like back to my cooking analogy, if you really get into it and you're excited about it, I think it's a fun conversation to have about how you can change something so silly, so simple and make a little change. If you're that kind of personality is like, I think it's stupid that, you know, right, these little changes are stupid. You're not wrong either. Like I said, it's so subtle. There is. Why don't they use solid copper? Scott, I really don't understand that. They do use solid, well, not solid copper. There's some alchemy in some of the wire.
We'll be right back. Ever wonder how your favorite entertainers and athletes made it from childhood to the spotlight? Join me, Nashville-based entertainment reporter Jennifer Vickery Smith, as I chat with moms of entertainers and entertaining moms on my hit podcast, Got It From My Mama. You'll hear delightful conversations with moms of everyone from the Jonas Brothers, Luke Bryan, Kelsey Ballerini, Steph Curry, Travis Kelce, and so many more, sharing the journey from a perspective only a mama can share. New episodes weekly as we share the best conversations of family, faith, and fame on the Got It From My Mama podcast.
So, hold on a second. And then again, this is also really important. This is why I went down this this rabbit hole years and years ago. I've been winding pickups for about 18 years, off and on, you know. And then for some reason, I don't know, a while back, I just got really, like a lot of you with these questions, I'm like, I got to know the answer. And what I really found getting into it was things are more dramatic than I ever thought they would. But for the most part, they are really subtle. And so... both those, like I said, two things can be true at the same time. They could be really dramatic and also very subtle, depending on you. So, David says, does anyone use a 41-gauge wire on a pickup? You know, at this point, I'm sure people have tried all kinds of things. There are a lot of things that when it comes to pickups and making pickups that you'll notice that if you don't stick with some of the main things, the main ingredients, like a 42-gauge wire for a pickup, you end up spending more time combating a problem, the pickups get a little too muted. In other words, like I said, there's just not a lot of clarity to them, or they get a little weird or a little muddy. The biggest thing you have to understand is this, is that when it really comes to pickups, and I've talked about this before, is that the magnets are relatively inexpensive and the wire is relatively expensive in comparison. Okay. So what I will tell you is that the thing that I've noticed taking apart, hundreds and hundreds of pickups over the years, is that cheap pickups tend to have one common thing in place, which is they seem to be really low on the wire and heavy on the magnet. And that's why a lot of players don't like cheap pickups, because what it does is it's something that they don't like, sound wise. And the reason they do that is because same reason, like if again, we could go back to food analogies, same reason why you see fillers in food and things, right? There's a way to save money. And the way to save money on pickups is with the wire more so than the magnet itself. Because here's the irony, really powerful ceramic magnets are very cheap to produce. So usually when somebody, picks up their $100 guitar and they don't like the sound of it, it's because there's a really powerful ceramic magnet there and a little bit of wire. And they're using a really powerful magnet because it's cheap, but also it makes up the difference of not having a lot of wire. And that's what you're noticing. The reason why this has become a silly subject on the internet to have about pickups is that, other than in the extreme cases of that, the majority of pickups now are made the same way. Look, overseas inexpensive manufacturing has learned to copy good things and just replicate that and increase the volume and, of course, decrease the labor and decrease the price of the materials and all those other things that factor in. So a lot of times there is a lot of inexpensive pickups that are actually the same exact recipe as an expensive pickup because they just copy it. Yeah, Brian says copper is expensive. It absolutely is. Somebody mentioned, I see in the comments, somebody mentioned about Sam Ash. If you guys watch or if you follow any of my social media, I posted that Sammy Ash passed away this week. As you guys know, he's been on this podcast before. Super nice guy. During the years, he has been someone who I have not only heavily respected, but somebody who has been super helpful to me as a person in this industry. I'm not going to share it with you because it was a personal advice, okay? But I feel, like if I don't say it, I feel like I'm dishonoring him to say. He gave me the best piece of advice about this industry I ever had when I was having a significant, small crises. I was really trying to deal with all this craziness of this YouTube world and the guitar industry and stuff. And, and a lot of people, especially when my channel saw like success. They see your channel grows or you get views and they don't realize all the things that come with that. And he was just instrumental in having great advice. And I can also say that a lot of times when I would have these, weekly shows and you guys would ask me things about the industry and I was giving you these point blank answers that I was like very informed, it was him many times that was, I would call him and I would say, hey, look, this happened. It might come up on this Friday show. And he was always forthcoming and honest and saying, hey, yeah, look, this is what's really going on, man. Yeah. And he would just tell me point blank. He never held back. And I always did him the courtesy of never saying like, oh, Sammy Ash said this week, this is why they're doing this. But he was always had great information. And also, I'd like to also point out, this is an important thing. When I started doing YouTube, as you guys know, I owned a store. And one of my first viral videos was what guitar would I buy for $500 at Sam Ash? And that story to me is still important to this day because I had a store, right? The Andertons guys were so huge. When I started doing YouTube, they were the biggest thing, ever. And they probably still are. I don't pay attention enough, I guess. But they were huge, right? And they would always like, what rig would you buy? And they would go into their store. And everybody, of course, because that was so huge when I would make content, everybody would put on like, what guitar would you buy? They would just like do that. And I just felt like if I went in my store and be like, I'd buy this guitar and it happens to be on sale for $499 and you buy it too. I was like, I just don't want it to, I just didn't want to do it in my store. So why I'm telling you that story is, I went to a bunch of stores and I said, I want to do you a video and I want to just buy a guitar. I want to just come in your store and I want to buy whatever guitar I can find for $500 and I want to film it. Every store I went to knew I had a store and absolutely refused to do it. They thought I had some kind of nefarious agenda. Why wasn't I doing it in my store? It was probably to insult their store. I was up to something. Maybe I had a marketing idea. They really didn't understand at the time. I was doing these videos, but they had nothing to do with my store. I didn't want my YouTube videos in my store to be connected because I was just trying to have some fun on the side, making some YouTube videos and talking about gear with my friends. And so I went to Guitar Center and they said no, but not because I had a store, just because Guitar Center just says no all the time. I've said this before. Marty Schwartz and I did a bunch of videos and they told us no. And think about this. Now Marty Schwartz is on TV. He's a signature model with Epiphone and, you know, and Guitar Center said no. And I contacted Sam Ash, the stores, and said, can I please come to your store and film a video called What Guitar Would I Buy for $500? Sammy Ash called me. He just called me on my cell phone. He didn't know who I was. Nobody knew who I was. I mean, I had like 30, 40,000 subs. I don't know at that time. It wasn't 100,000, that's for sure. It's like 30,000. Because remember, my channel subs, I kind of moved really quickly at the beginning. And his first thing out of his mouth wasn't not only yes, but he's like, yeah, if you want, you can come before we open the store, or we can just close the store for an hour or so, and you can do the video. And I go, oh, no, I don't need anything like that. It's just going to be me and my two friends with my cell phone. You know, they have a cell phone, I have a cell phone, we're just gonna film. And I go, actually, no, we don't want it to be that way. I told him, we understand that we shouldn't film people in the store, so we'll make sure we keep the cameras, you know, out of people's faces and stuff, and just kind of film it. And I filmed that video. I think that video now has 2.1 million views on that video. And the reason it has 2 million views, so you guys know, and you can choose to believe me or not, is because that video is 100% honest and it was 100% sincere. I just went into a store. I'd never been in that actual Sam Ash before. So you guys know, if you're familiar with the Phoenix area where I live, that Sam Ash store is like 50 minutes away without traffic. And I own my own store. I had no reason to go across town and visit a Sam Ash. I went in that store for the first time and I found a guitar and just so happened to work out great. And some people even said that they staged some of the guitars. And so, you know, that conversation with Sammy was Thursday and we filmed it Friday morning because I had to film early so I can get back to work. It was the thing I remember. It's what started our friendship together. I'm sorry if I'm going on about this, but I just want to let you know, man, what a great guy he was. Because not because he was a great guy, but because that is so unique in this industry. And you know what? I'm going to share his advice with you. I couldn't understand why a company had a problem with me, when I basically did a video that they obviously, you know, like, you know, very little of my content is sponsored in most part. They didn't sponsor it. They didn't fund it. I spotted with my own money. I did everything and the video produced a lot of good things for them and they were still, disgruntled and vocally disgruntled with me. And I didn't understand the concept. Right? I'm like, who are you to tell me anything? I don't work for you. I don't work with you. I don't know what's going on. Why do you feel the need to have an issue? And I told him, because I reached out to him because I said, I don't understand, because it'd been the third or fourth time a company had decided for some reason to contact me and tell me how much they don't like my content about them that didn't involve them and was positive content. And he said, Phil, this is a bitchy industry and they will complain about anything. He's like, it's catty. And he says, I've been in it a long time. And he said, this is what he said. Obviously, that was the advice, but he also said, they're not going to like anything that wasn't what they thought it should be. And I was like, great. And now I've realized, and I tell you guys this all the time, now I've realized it doesn't matter when I say, hell with this company and like it, and you say the same thing I say, but that video was good. You didn't say anything bad. I've learned a lot of people in this industry are just going to be upset because it's not what they thought I should say. It's not what they thought. Yeah, so that's all. And like I said, and he said it's a caddy industry and they just like the bitch. So that's what I learned from him, besides many other things. So Sammy was a great guy, and Sam Ash is a great store. And like I said, we've talked about him many times, and we'll miss him. So there you go. And my heart goes out, and thoughts and prayers to the family. So you guys know, Sammy was young. He was 65, I believe. But he wasn't just 65. 65 is young. Again, we have this conversation with people all the time about what young is. It's relative to other people's ages. But 65 is young. But more importantly, dude, he was a healthy guy. 65, healthy guy. So you guys know, he got cancer. But, you know, he wasn't a 65 unhealthy guy. He was a 65-year-old healthy guy, which in my opinion now is like, that's like a, you know, 50-year-old dude, maybe. You know, you can. So there you go. In his honor, because when he came on the show, he said, I don't want to talk about my stores. I just want to talk about guitars. Let's just do the same. Let's follow his advice. I don't want to talk about anything. I just want to talk about guitars. Let's do it. He says, looking to buy a 2004 birthday year guitar for my granddaughter, because it says granddaughter. While I can afford it, she's into metal. Suggestions. What I would do, especially if you can use like the Wayback Machine on the internet or things like that, I would go try look at 2004 NAMM and see what guitar was released that year. You know what would be cooler than just a birthday year guitar? Is something that came out that year, not just a year that guitar was built. So that might be something interesting. 2004 was some interesting stuff, interesting products. And whether you go with a mainstream like Fender or Gibson type product, you could do that, or an Ibanez or whatever. Or you can just see if, like I said, what companies released the guitar that year, or what brand started in 2004, maybe through some internet searches. That's what I would do for fun, right? Because that could be fun. That could be a fun thing. What's cool about stuff like that, in my opinion, is that even if, like, think of this, you could get a 2004 Fender, you can get a 2004 Gibson, you get a 2004 Ibanez, and yeah, you'll have a guitar from the year, but it's a guitar that anybody can still get. It's just they can't, you know, that year, you know, as we know, if you go too far back, birthday year guitars, you know, you're not going to buy 62 Strats, not really common now. But wouldn't it be cooler, in my opinion, wouldn't it be cooler if you got a guitar and it's like, this year's the, you know, especially if it failed, right? If I got a guitar and it's, oh yeah, it's a birth year guitar and it was a cool guitar for that year, but then it, you know, they stopped making it 3 years later, that could be really cool. So something like that, something would be interesting like that, is a suggestion. So, Steven says Daisy Rock, you know, I don't know if I'd pick Daisy Rock, but I understand where you're going with this. I think you might have meant it as a joke too on top of that. Somebody said a Parker Fly. Parker guitars were still in existence in 2004. So that would be a cool guitar. I mean, but that's what I would do. I would look at, you could probably 2004. Oh, think of this, think about this. 2004 predates YouTube. I think YouTube was started in 2006. So I was going to say, you can go to YouTube and go to NAMM shows from 2000, and there's no NAMM shows. You might want to look up an old Guitar World magazine 2004 edition, like year-end edition, where they highlight all the products of the year. You could probably do that. There's probably a way to do the PDF online or go physically get the magazine and then look at the products that came out that year. Nikos says, hey Phil, the scarf joint near the headstock on my Soundgear bass, Soundgear is an Ibanez brand, model in the Ibanez series, in his Ibanez Soundgear bass is more visible, and I can feel the two pieces almost separating when I touch it. Okay, so we need to really clarify what you mean by separating when you touch it. If you can see them flexing apart, there's a crack in there, you definitely want to glue that. It's not going to get better. It's only going to get worse. That's the first thing. But I really would like to know, obviously, it's going to, if it's really separating, because that's one thing. What I will tell you, what's common with scarf joints, with any time you glue two pieces of wood together, wood dries at different rates. There's just nothing you can do about that. And sometimes those lines where you glue two pieces of wood become more predominant. You see them and you can definitely feel them more. And especially, you have to understand, this is why I make the videos I do. This is what the whole, you know, nylon sock on my hand that everybody likes to make fun of, which is fine with me. The reason I did that was because I really understand guitar customers. I should say guitar players, but I'm going to say customers. To me, a player is one thing, but not only because I've sold guitars, so many guitars to so many players, I've fixed so many guitars and I've had that one-on-one interaction. And what I've learned is, and I've said this before, your tongue, your ears, your fingertips, they're very sensitive and your eyes, right? And they feel, hear, taste, you name it, see things. And those little things can be so dramatic, okay? And a lot of times when players have their hands on things and you're touching like the guitar and you're touching the neck or touching the bridge, little things can be dramatic because you're so sensitive. These are sensitive things that literally feel and get annoyed by things. So a lot of times when you have your hand on the neck, that little teeny difference where if it was anywhere else on the guitar, you wouldn't have noticed or cared, but because your finger has to touch it, it feels like a giant speed bump almost, like, you know, almost like a crevasse, right? Just a giant crevice. And you're literally like, my thumb's falling into that line and it's just nothing, right? So I understand. So it's very sensitive. And this is why I ask you, because sometimes I'm treating you like I would treat you if you came to my shop and you wanted me to repair something. Sometimes people talk like, oh, Phil, it's so dramatic. And I look and I go, it's not very much, but I get it. I get it. I'd be just as annoyed with it as you. So, I need you to pay attention if it really is flexing. In other words, you can see a physical crack and it is opening if you flex on the headstock very lightly. Okay. I mean, very lightly. And then that you definitely need to glue and fix. If it's not moving, and it is possible that I'm right, that it's just two pieces of wood and they've dried at different rates and one is shrunk, right, more so than the other, and there's this little bump, there's a couple ways to fix that. What's nice about that neck, even if it has a finish on it, whether it has a finish on it or not, in most cases you can take some quadruple-aught or triple-aught steel wool and just, you know, I always say, and painters tape up the pickups because some people freak out and go, oh, and the fibers will get on the pickups. I'm like, well, just don't get it near the pickups. and I just smooth it out. That's all you'd have to do. And then sometimes you want to smooth the whole neck to make it uniform. The only time that's going to be tricky is if there's a heavy gloss to the neck. But in my experience, I've not seen a whole lot of sound gear bases that are gloss in the neck unless they're painted. And if it was painted, you shouldn't really be seeing that line or feeling it at all. So I'm assuming that it's an unpainted line, and that's what you probably have on there is some clear polyurethane. There'll be something on there. Very rarely are the Ibanez sound gears or those bases no finish, but it's possible. Either way, though, that's even better. But triple aught, then quadruple aught steel wool, smooth out that little bump. You won't even feel it. Happens all the time. Some of you guys got skunk stripes in your strats. You can do the same thing to that. Some of you guys have multi-laminate necks and you can feel a little, like I said, the two pieces, you feel a little line. You can, again, steel wool will take care of that. It's, I've done it 1,000 times to 1,000 customers' guitars and no one's ever came back and going, oh, what the hell? They always go, yeah, it's great. Looks great. You just blend it out. It's really nice. Super easy. If you want to use some kind of sandpaper, or if you want to use a scotch pad, you can use, like, there's a white scotch pad, stuff like that, because some people have a hang up of getting steel wool. I don't know. You know, it's funny. For me, the problem is like, you know, when you do something for as long as I did, and then you come to YouTube, you know, and you do content, it's like no one ever said a thing to me for 15 years, no one said a single solitarily complaining thing. But then you do a video and all of a sudden there's people like, don't ever use steel wool. And I'm like, well, I mean, where did you guys all come from? Like, I literally worked in front of people all day in a store for a decade and a half and no one complained. So I'm just sharing that with you guys. There you go. I just thought I'd share the funniness with you. All right. The 59 sound. I love that sign on. Great sign on. Phil, what do you think about Fender charging $18.99 for the Mike McCready made in Mexico road worn Strat? I keep staring at it, but my man, that's a lot of money for a non-USA Fender. Okay. So funny enough, I believe it was, it was on the show. I forgot the viewer that said it, but a viewer a long time ago said, wouldn't it be cool if Fender would make a custom shop in Mexico, right? And maybe do relics, you know, right? Or, you know, non-relics and relics, but do a custom shop in Mexico and get the prices down. I really believe, one, I think that was a great idea. And I would hope one day that actually happens. I would love to see a Fender custom shop Mexico and Fender custom shop US. That being said, that's exactly what I think a custom shop, if Fender custom shop was a thing and they were going to make custom shop Strats, that's what they would mark them for, right? This is a signature artist guitar. What I don't know, so you know, is it limited edition? Is it, you know, only so somebody says, Knight Rider Band says they made it for 100. So only 100 guitars were made? I don't understand. What drives up the price? I'm really trying to understand the new world, because remember, these price, like talking about prices now is almost impossible for me. About anything. I mean, we could be talking about carrots and zucchini, and I don't understand the pricing now, because everything's gotten so crazy expensive so fast. And guitars are no different. You know, basically $1,899 with tax, $2,000 for a made in Mexico guitar feels just crazy to me. But I don't feel like it was a long time ago, wasn't that little time ago either, that where a Japanese made in Japan guitar was $2,000. I was like, what? Made in Japan, $2,000, right? I mean, made in Indonesian guitars are $1,500. Strandbergs made in Indonesia are $2,400, you know, far, far past where it made in Mexico is. So, you know, the sad thing is you have to kind of come, this, I'm just giving you my insight. You have to come to some kind of decision in yourself what the made in America means to you, because the reality is the world, the youth, the industry, they're not valuing it that way. They're like, hey, we just need to make guitars and we're going to make them good and we're going to make them, you know, the way we are, and this is going to be the price for them, and that's just what's going to be. My question would be, because, I mean, I'm a Pearl Jam fan as much as most people. They're not really like in my top 10 bands or anything, but I like them fine. So, I mean, it's a little different for me when I always say your guy, right? So I go, if Eddie Van Halen's your guy, if Zakk Wylde's your guy, if, you know, Eric Johnson's your guy, if Mike McCready's your guy, Tom DeLonge is your guy, you know, you're more, it would appeal to me more because he would be like somebody I really want his instrument. But I guess my question to you would be, what do you think it would cost if they made that exact guitar in the U.S.? So if they made a Mike McCready signature relict guitar made in USA, and not what you feel it should be priced at, what do you think Fender, if you're watching this show, you're interested in the industry, right? What do you guys think? Let me tell you, let's do this. You guys tell me, honestly, don't BS yourselves. If there was a Mike McCready signature relic Stratocaster made in the USA by Fender to come out this month, what do you think Fender would tag that at? Based on, that's what I'm really curious to know. And that'll tell you if the made in Mexico is a good deal or not. Right? Anyone got a suggestion? I'll start it. I mean, I shouldn't, because that kind of contaminates it, right? Because I haven't really thought of it. Let me think about it. So relic Strats, and again, I don't know if you could call it custom shop, but it's going to be semi-custom. It's going to be team built, which I would say the made in Mexico would be team built. I would say a team built made, team built made in USA relic Stratocaster is usually between $3,500 to $4,500 is what I would say. See, a lot of people are saying $35. Somebody says $5, somebody says $4, somebody says $28. And again, there's no wrong answers here, right? Because it's not we don't know. We're not Fender. We don't price like them. The reality is, no matter what we come up with, Fender probably would have doubled it. But it's really about, what do you think they would do it? A lot of you guys say $25. I think if they were going to do it in the US, I would say $35. I think it's got to be, right? 35. I mean, it's probably going to be more, right? They'll probably do it at five. But what I think at 35. So I think a lot of people agree. So I guess the million-dollar question would be $1,899. $2,000 is a lot, but is it a far, you know, right? It's It's if 35 is what we're guitar community. If we think 35 is what a Main USA signature Relic Strat should go for, half Made in Mexico is minimum, right? Not minimum, what I'm trying to say. Like, that's the most. Like, you can't imagine it would be less than half. So that's half. That's basically half. They're a little bit more than half, right? Is that about right? So a lot of people saying 4,000. So I guess that's what I think. That's your core, your question. What do I think of them charging that? I think that's the number they're going to charge. Now, do I think that's right? Do I think it's fair? Do I think it's, you know, I have no idea. You know, I'm not a buyer. I wouldn't buy that guitar at $1,200 because, again, like I say, he's not my guy. I'm not really interested in it. I have a Relic Stratocaster somewhere behind me on this wall. Do I? Oh, yeah, it's out of view. You can't see it. Oh, there it is. You can see the corner over there. I have that right there. And that was a fortune. I think I have like four, maybe three. I call them my COVID guitars that I bought during COVID because, you know, we've already had that conversation. Sadness, stupidity, depression, all those things. It relates to, hey, they'll feel better if I get this. But that being said, you know, I mean, I don't think I'd ever do that again. Actually, I know for a fact. I was actually having lunch today with my wife, and I told my wife I would never buy any of the guitars I bought at COVID again, ever again. I don't mean those guitars, just any of those price points again. I don't care how much guitars get expensive. I'm never going to do it again. So I just feel like it was a lot of money, and I did it at that moment, and it was a moment, and it's over. And I'm sure a lot of you right now are nodding because I think a lot of us did this, you know, bought a lot of stuff. It's a different time. Isn't it funny? All right, let's go on to the next subject. But thank you guys for giving feedback on that. Like I said, it was interesting to see how many came up with the same answer and we were kind of all thinking the same. Okay, Parker. He wants to know, Phil, what did I think? He wants to know what I think. What did I think of the Tone Master Princeton versus my 68 Princeton? Just need for bedroom jamming. Thank you. So the Tone Master series, I've already said, I really like this stuff. Okay, I've been very clear about this. I really like it. I think it's a really cool sounding amp. I think they do a lot of great things. There's a couple things I don't like about it. There's a couple things I do like about it. Overall, I like it. I have a Tone Master Deluxe Reverb. I've tried all the Tone Master series amps, and my personal taste was I like the Deluxe Reverb. I would not, it's weird. It's a weird thing. I would pick my 68 Princeton, so my real tube Princeton, I would pick that over my Tone Master Deluxe Reverb. But I would not pick my Deluxe Reverb, or I would not pick my Princeton over my real Deluxe Reverb, if that makes any sense. Hope this is making sense. And in your question, what do I think of those two amps? I think I would buy, for the price, I know you're looking at Princeton's, but let me give you my 2 cents. If I was looking at a Tone Master Princeton, a real Princeton, like a 68 or 65 reissue tube amp, and a Tone Master Deluxe Reverb, I might go with the Tone Master Deluxe Reverb. So, My issue, so you know, is this. I don't use my Princeton for breakup. So I don't turn, like my Deluxe Reverb and my, I like it cranked, attenuated and cranked up. I liked it, you know, breaking up. I love that sound. The Princeton's a little bit different. It's not my main thing. So for breakup, I like the Princeton for clean. The thing I love about the Princeton, why I've had it and used it for so many years, and I did a video recently why I still love it, is because to me, it is the best sounding, warmest tube amp that I own, super quiet. It's like a luxury practice amp, right? That's what I love it for. And I can play, you know, play with a drummer with it lightly and stuff, but I don't. I use it mostly for practice. I use it mostly for just playing and just, I love it. I love how the 10-inch speaker works. I love how everything works at a lower volume. It just, to me, it's like my favorite lower volume amp. So that's what I love about it. So the Tone Master series isn't something I'm after because I'm not after a Princeton that I can crank and attenuate or do for different things too. And like I said, playing the Tone Master series, I like the Super Reverb a lot. I did. And I like the Twin a lot. But I preferred the Deluxe Reverb of the 4. This is where I landed with it. No real reason. I wish I could tell you like why I think that. And if it sounds the best, I couldn't say any of those things. I just preferred it. Antique Rocker says, one, do you know of a clip-on tuner that would work on an Eart headless guitar? I used on my Eart headless guitar and all my headless guitars, I use a Snark. It clips on fine. I have a D'Addario tuner, clip-on tuner. They've all worked for some reason. I've just kind of, you know, manipulate it for a second, clip it on there. So I did this trick many years ago, if that helps you guys. If you have a guitar like the headless guitar and you can't get a clip-on tuner to clip on it, I clip my clip-on tuners to the handle of your amplifier and tune with your amplifier. It absolutely works. It works in real time. Works perfectly. You just clip the clip-on tuner right onto the handle of the amp. Even if it's a head, as long as the head's sitting on the cabinet. It works best with combos. And of course, you have to turn the volume up a little bit. It doesn't have to be loud, but it has to be enough to where the amp vibrates. But it will work. Two, this is the second part. How can I tell if the pickups on the Telecaster I just bought are Fender Texas Specials? You might have to flip them, take them out, flip them upside down, look at them. There's the only other cheat way you can do it is you can go online and see what the Texas Specials resistance are spec'd at. So like if it's like 7K, you know, 7.3K resistance on the bridge or whatever it is. You can plug a guitar cable and a multimeter onto it like I do in all the videos and test them that way. The why this is important is where those tricks came from. You know, the old trick of sticking a guitar cable into the output of jack of a guitar and then putting the alligator clips of a multimeter on the ground and the hot of the cable and checking pickups that way with all the volumes full force. That is a there's a ton of reasons why people did it, but the biggest users I ever saw were vintage guitar buyers. It was the fastest way you could check to see if the pickups in this vintage guitar were what they were supposed to be. So generally speaking, if you know that, you know, this guitar is supposed to have some PAFs and they're like 8.9K and you throw it on there and it's reading somewhere between 8.5 and, you know, 8.9K or something like that, you can go, oh, okay, it's probably likely the original pickups, you know, and that just gives you an idea before you can, you know, start. It's like a start of the investigation. You got to understand the reason why you would do that is a lot of people who buy vintage guitars and especially buy them and flip them, they don't disassemble every guitar just from the start. They got to figure out first how, you know, is it even worth start taking this guitar apart to validate if it's worth the $10, $15, $20, $30, $50,000. That's the first thing you can do is just see how close those pickups read to what the specifications on those are. And that'll give you an idea. And then if you flip it and you see labels, that helps too. But Fender's notorious for not putting labels. They just put the blue and the red dots on things. But if they sound good, then it doesn't matter. I want to say it's Karma and Kerosene is the name. Phil, I'm developing a music accessory product, but I don't know how to price it wholesale for stores. What is the typical markup stores put on items like mic stands and guitar stands? So you specifically, mic stands and guitar stands are high margin products for dealers. So the thing about music stores and music vendors is that certain staples like the Shure SM57-58 have not really changed in price over the years. So a lot of times to make money on that, they will sell a SM57. I mean, it's not uncommon for a smaller mid-sized dealer to pay 10%, 15% less than what you're paying for a standard mic like that. Because they're going to add on the cable and this mic stand. Guitar stands are another, again, the smaller mid-sized dealers really rely, and the big chains too, they rely on a little bit more margin in those accessories. Because they're add-ons, right? It's like you sell a guitar and maybe the guitar, if somebody buys a $300 guitar and they get 10% off that guitar, a typical dealer would expect to see on a $300 guitar a 90% profit. And that's just on what they paid for the guitar versus what they're getting from you physical dollars. They would get a $90 profit then if you got 10% off, you immediately take that down to a $60 profit. So they sell you a $300 guitar, essentially, and they're going to make a $60 profit because they give a discount. And that's not in count. That's not taking account, you know, the employee or the, you know, the air conditioning or the anything else, just physically what they paid to what you're paying for the guitar. So they really, to pad up that, you know, the money, they really need to get you to buy like a guitar stand, a guitar cable, a guitar tuner. All those things will have a lot more a margin. On most cases, you can see double and sometimes triple. So in other words, if you pay $10 for a tuner, you could see them trying to sell it for $20. If they paid $15 for a guitar stand, you could see them try to sell it to the customer for what did I say? $15? So it's over 30, double, right? Now, sometimes even more so, it depends on the dealer. Everybody's walked into a store where they're like, really, you guys are crazy. And that's what they're doing. They're charging three times what they paid for the smaller stuff. The other reason they do that too is because it's really common in a music store, is if a customer asks you for a discount on an item that's hard to discount, because again, your margins are slim, you might say, yeah, I can't do that, but I can give you half off on these items. And you're selling items essentially at cost or just above cost. And you know, kind of retaining some kind of profit that way. So in your case, your dealers are going to want at least a double mark margin, especially the big chains are going to want that for sure in volume. But my guess is, because you said you just started this company, starting out, you're going to be starting out with the smaller dealers as well. One thing I will tell you is that it is the future now. And unless your product I don't know how to give advice anymore on how companies starting out should interact with dealers. Dealers are very expensive. It's a very expensive proposition, comparatively speaking. You know, it's kind of like, to me, dealers, and I mean this, like I said, because I love dealers, and I told you there's a place for them for sure. But in the new world, especially with new products, where it's not used gear. I think dealers, really the big thing for dealers is staying in the used gear market. I think there's a lot to be had there. A lot of us are really irritated with Reverb and eBay and crazy sellers and crazy everything. And so I think going in a store and buying a used piece of gear still has value to a lot of us. No matter how much crap you're buying online, I think if you walk in a music store and you find a used piece of gear and you can pick it up and play it and buy it, I think it has value, and I think that's going to have value for a long time. But when it comes to like if you're selling guitar stands and music stands, one thing I would think about is maybe if you could sell direct to consumers. You know, the cost to sell direct consumers is astronomically cheaper than selling to dealers, because one, you can be more competitive with your pricing, but also you don't have to just cut out the dealer margin. You can keep a chunk of that and use that for advertising on, you know, on Instagram or you know, Facebook or, you know, YouTube and stuff like that. And you know, remember, the advertising can be $0 if you want to create your own content and really kind of get your name out there and make a community of buyers. And that's a good way to start your company, because like I said, this is going to be tough. I mean, yeah, if you go to NAMM and buy a booth, it's going to be crazy money. If you drive to your local stores and then try to drive across the country and go store to store, I've told this story before, I'll tell you again. I've found almost no exception to this rule when it comes to dealers. Small, and when I say small, mid-sized dealers, and small, mid-sized dealers, you know, is up to at least $1 million in sales a year. Right, you're still pretty small in the grand scheme of things if you're selling $1 million worth of product a year. That doesn't mean if you're selling a lot less than that, you're a nano nothing company. No, it's just, even if you're selling $1 million worth of product a year or more, you're still considered a small business in the guitar industry. So that being said, when you're a small business, you know, like all small businesses, you spend a lot of time putting out fires. You know, you got to deal with everything that's happening to you day to day. So somebody comes in your store, they got a revolutionary new guitar stand. It's the most amazing thing since anything. You get this store to buy 20 of them, 30 of them, give it a shot. They sell them out in a week. Your brain says they're going to call you that next week and order 20 more. The reality is you're going to come back finally 6 months later thinking that you're going to walk into a store with a stack of your unsold merchandise and an owner going, yeah, it was the worst purchase ever. But instead you're going to walk in and going, hey, you remember me? I had my stands. And you're like, yeah, we sold them like in a day. And you're going to be like, why didn't you call me? And like, I don't know. It was like, what, a week ago when you're here? And you're like, no, it was 6 months ago. So you understand you're going to constantly be coming back and getting, you know, just because sell through doesn't automatically mean more purchase. And then and again, I'm not trying to talk you out of things. You asked for it. You asked for this. So you asked for the feedback. Bigger dealers like the Sweetwater guys and stuff, you're not even going to get a, in fact, I almost slipped up and said the name of the people that the buyers, because, you know, okay. But you're not going to get them to even, you're not even going to get on, you're not going to get them. if you get one of them, one of those guys to get on the phone or get an email correspondence with you, that will be super lucky of you to get on that, you know, to get their time, but it will not involve in a purchase. They don't care how interesting your product is. The first thing they're going to do is look how many times it's searched on their website. That's what's a big deal for them. And if the search is none, that's even worse. They're going to look to see who's also carrying your product. One thought is most people are going to be like, if you try to approach the bigger dealers, especially ones like Sweetwater that try to buy, you might think like, oh, I'm not carrying anywhere else. You'll be exclusive. That they don't care. They don't want that. They want to see that you have other dealers. Those dealers are buying and flipping and selling and making money. And then they're going to go, okay, that's something. Like I said, they're not trying to sell your product. They're trying to get your product's customers to come to them. They're very smart. At some point, they figure out, like, look, they got all their customers. They want your customers too. they want you to bring traffic and product, our customers, to them, and they'll carry your product because of that. But so I would say, maybe think about that first, you know, offer a deal. There's communities like this. Look, you're here live. You see this is going on. There's a lot of people here, you know, and then that will get some word of mouth. Get exciting. I would also tell new companies like you, and I'm really glad you did the super chat. I get a lot of these emails and calls privately sent to me. You know, I take up time a lot of times to give you guys, you know, give them feedback. And then a lot of times I never get a response back and I tell myself I should never do this. But I like that you did this publicly, because I'm going to tell you another thing that's really cool is that another thing to pay attention is don't just focus on YouTubers with 100,000, whatever the hell you perceive me to be. Seriously, there's a lot of value in mid-sized, small YouTube channels. These channels, you know, to you might see 100 views, you might see 1,000 views and think that's nothing, but it's really about ROI. It's like, if you can send a guitar stand, a mic stand to an influencer channel that literally can help you sell 10 products to that, you know, return investments really, really good. Okay. It's like the Moneyball game, right? Now you just get 10 more channels to do that. The other thing pay attention to is this live show. You're hanging out at this live show. Go hang out on all the live shows. But here's what you got to do. Try to figure out, I'm giving away too much, so you know, but try to figure out who the community leaders in these chats are. There are people in these chats that I can tell you that, you know, regardless of how much they watch me, I know their names. I'm not going to do it right now, but I'm going to tell you that there are people in the chats of these channels like mine that literally they are interacting, they're speaking up, they're talking. Other people in these chats are actually paying attention to what they're doing and saying. And believe it or not, you can message them directly. You can click on them, go right to the thing and say, hey, I have a product, I'd like to send you one. And they're going to be like, I don't make content, why would you want to send me in a product? Because like I told you, before you give all your money to the NAMM show and all your money to the dealers for margin and all your monies to advertising, maybe get somebody in one of these chats. You can try to sell your product directly in the chats to these viewers, but you have to understand you're just going to be the guy selling your crap on a chat. You know, it's not going to have any value. But what's it worth for a moderator? What's it worth for someone who's in these chats every week to just all of a sudden say, hey, Phil, I got one of those new blah, blah, blah stands and it's really awesome. Have you checked it out? And I'm grabbing onto it because it's organic. Maybe they're championing your brand because, hey, yeah, you may have given them a free stand, but I have this statement when it comes to people and selling, like, oh, you only said it's good because it's free. Well, if it's a piece of crap, what do I care if it's free? Right? It only has value. There's only the only valuable products to anyone, including you guys right now. If somebody sent you a free guitar stand, I'm sure like there's 1,000 of you hanging out, but I'm sure a big percentage are like, I would take a free stand. But the truth is, if this guy asking the question, if he sent half the audience right now, 500 people, a free stand that was the worst stand you ever had, no, I'd say maybe if he's lucky, 5 of you would go, it was a really great stand. But the rest of you would be like, that thing was junk. And not because you're being honest because you didn't get paid. It's because the value of your statement, it has to be a trade. there has to be commerce here. It has to be, he gave you a quality thing and now you want to say something nice about it. You're not going to say something nice just because somebody gave you something horrible. Right. So that's my suggestions. And the reason I say that is because I think everyone gets hyper focused on, oh, if I could just get Rhett Shaw, I'm just picking up Rhett. If I could just get Rick Beato to tell his fan base that my guitar stands great. I'm not picking on you. I'm just illustrating. Or this mic stands amazing. Yeah, but there is a faster, cheaper, better way to do that. And it can be done as simple as this. Right. And like I said, and so it's just my two cents. I see it constantly with companies. I've, you know, helped a lot of companies, do exactly what you did, what you're doing, jump startup. And I, this is the same advice I give them. I tell them like, you know, you don't have to throw a ton of money at something. You just sweat equity it out and you get a community going, get somebody invested in your product, get somebody excited about it. John says, hey, Phil, would like to know whatever happened with your inquiry into visiting Zagger Guitars and getting a lowdown on their guitars. Nothing ever happened. They copyright striked my video. I think I told you guys this. The Zagger. We did a podcast. I did a podcast. This is a couple years back. Somebody asked me about Zagger Guitars, and I said I was really confused and about where they're made, right? I think that confusion is not as confusing. I think they've been a little bit more clear that they're import guitars and that they're kind of set up here in the United States. But even so, you know, even that's my understanding that they are import instruments set up in the U.S. I've had physically, I don't want to say physically, I've had a ton of people reach out to me and go, they're made in USA and I have one and they're made in USA. And I'm like, okay, so yours is made in the USA? Because I'm very confused by this. And so basically, in that podcast, I mentioned that I would be more than willing to pay to fly out to their facility, hang out, do stuff. So, you know, I have no problem. Again, if this ever gets to them, I have no problem signing. I've done it millions of times. I haven't done it millions of times. I've done it many times. I've signed an NDA. I've signed NDAs with companies. Basically, it's a non-disclosure. It says I can't put out any footage of your facility that you don't approve. So I mean, that's about as easy as it gets, man. I'll go there. I will do all the work. I will pay for all this, my time and money. I will film. And then I will put together a video and I will send it to you. And then if you basically, because companies do it to me all the time when I've done these videos, like, hey, I don't want that part in there. I don't want that part in there. I want that taken out. I take it out. For those of you guys that think that's kind of a not the best way to do it, let me just tell you, I've learned that's the best way to do it, because what happens is they'll guard you while you're there and they won't let you see it in the first place. So I've just learned, just let them make the video and let them see the after idea. Right. And in my experience, I can't recall any time where somebody didn't ask me to remove something that wasn't technically just a proprietary thing, had nothing to do with, you know, don't let the audience really see this. It had literally to do like, you know, like, yeah, I get it. You don't want your competitors to see your secret winding thing or your secret this or whatever, or that part, you know, is weird. But no, I've never heard from them. like I said, I'm like you guys. Look, I don't have any ill will towards companies. I just don't like the confusion if we can sort it out, right? I've said this before. Zagger Guitars, if you don't know what Zagger Guitars is, they, in my opinion, created the greatest state saying ever, which is easy play system. I think the term easy play is to me a marketing way of saying it's set up properly. They probably have a different opinion about that. That's fine. I would love to go there and learn. Maybe I'm wrong. Me, though, I'm giving them the credit of saying Easy Play is an ingenious idea. I would love to tell people, like, oh, did you set up the guitar? No, I made it Easy Play. Like, that's a great idea. But I would love to check them out and learn about them. And even if it is, like I said, they're made in overseas and they're just set up here, I'll learn about that process. Like I said, there you go. So thank you for asking about that stuff. I love it when you guys ask me about follow-ups and things like that, but no, I never heard from any of them. Never heard anything. Just like, Dean Zielinski, I told you guys, he reached out, he wanted me to review guitar. I told him that he'd have to give some money to charity, and I never heard from him again. So there you go. You know, what are you going to do? Like I said, I offered to do the work for free and give some money to charity, and he's not interested. That's his prerogative. And you know what? It's not a shame thing or anything. It's just, I'm just telling you guys, I'm just giving you the updates on what happened. And in his case, so you know, we did a Dean Zelinsky guitar, and it did really well on the channel. So there you go. He gave it the office again. You know, it's he may not have value to have, you know, pay, because either way, to him it's paying money. Whether he gives it to charity or gives it to me, to him it's paying money. So it's not that I don't think he wants to give money to charity. I think he's just not interested in paying to have content, and now I'm not interested in doing free content. In other words, I'll do it free for me, but I'm not interested in doing content that doesn't give value to something, whether it's to me, to you, or to a charity. Somebody's got to benefit from it, in my opinion. And you guys voted that you weren't super excited about seeing another Zelinsky guitar on the channel. Andy says Zagger puts out lots of ads, and those ads to me are slightly confusing. Hero Glop says, what are my three cheapest guitars? Personal collection, not for YouTube. I have a Dane Electro that I paid $300 for. I have my Dana Scoop. I'm into it for $350. Maybe it was $400, $399. My Ibanez RG7620, which is a Made in Japan 7-string. It's black. You guys seen it a couple times on the wall. I think I remember paying $350 for it, but I might have paid $300 for it. I mean, there's a ton of guitars that I have because, I mean, inflation, you know, before there was inflation, a lot of the guitars that I have that are nicer, they were just not that much. I have a Paul Reed Smith S2 semi-hollow single cut that I paid, I think it was $5-something new for it. It was on Blowout and I bought it. And that one you've seen in videos, I still have that. Anything past the pandemic, it's been just nuts priced, stuff like that. But that's just a couple. I don't know if those are my three cheapest ones or least expensive, but there's three. Yeah, somebody said, wouldn't my ukuleles be the... Yeah, I mean, I have acoustics too, that I have acoustics that I have owned that are like $200. In Cortex says, hey, Phil, do you still love your Vader bass? I love my Vader bass. Would love to see a comparison video of the Ibanez EHB1000 30-inch headless bass. Yeah, I'd probably check that out. If I could get my hands on one, you know, to borrow it and stuff and do the video. But absolutely, the Vader bass is a, you know, it's tough to, you know, when you guys go, do you still love it? Well, I mean, I loved it when I got it, but remember, it was custom. I had it custom made. So, of course, it's pretty freaking awesome. And then basses are a much different animal for me than guitars. Like I said, I own 4 basses, and 3 of them are custom made, basically. So, I mean, of course, you know, it's a very simple thing. And it's a very different animal to me than guitars. I don't collect basses. I just use them for my practical purposes of using them. @10, hey, what's up? He says, hey, Phil, on a Fender Jaguar, would a Floyd Rose cover the evidence of a stock tremolo? No, it wouldn't. I mean, no one's ever asked me to do it. So I'm just doing off of like I can picture in my head the hole that's in the Jaguar is square. The Floyd is going to be long. The problem is if you did the route behind the bridge on the Floyd, no, the answer is no, it's not going to work. My concern is the placement, because that Floyd has to go in a certain spot. Sadly enough, I can't give you a for sure, but my initial guess is that it's not going to work without you doing something to modify it. So this was probably the craziest question I've ever got, because now all I can think about, I want not only to answer your question and talk about it, but I just want to know why you want to put a Floyd Rose on a Jaguar. Like, what is it that is making you think that's such a great idea? I mean, I like Floyds and I like Jaguars, so I'm like, okay, I could see the connect, but I just, no, that's where I'm lost. You, I'm like, yeah, no. I'm like, I don't know, but you know what, if you get it to work, let me know. I would almost say that if I was gonna do that as a project, like, let me put it this way. If you said, I have a Fender Jaguar and I want to put a Floyd in it, I'm not so much worried about the neck. Okay, we can get the locking nut on the neck. That's not going to be a problem. I would almost say, hey, could we order a body from like Warmoth, like a Jaguar body, and without a bridge route in it, and then we'll figure out and I'll put it in. I would rather if you were giving the project to me to do, I would rather start with no bridge mounted in it and just route out the Floyd Rose template for the top and the bottom of the body and start from scratch before I try to figure out that mess. So, yeah, that one's nuts. The craziest thing I've ever put a Floyd in is a Telecaster, and that was nuts. That was nuts. Okay. Vimps, again, thank you for the super chat. Curtis C. Get it, Curtis, and then the letter C. Curtis C. says, Phil, do you think Sweetwater is being less than transparent, selling on Reverb as Gear Nuts, which seems like a different store? Sam Ash Music sells exactly as they are on Reverb. No shells. So what's funny at Sammy, no shells at Sammy. So, you know, interesting. That's an interesting thought. I don't necessarily, I intuitively don't go, no, they're totally up. I don't really understand the decision. I think that's my problem, is I don't understand the decision why they did it that way. They're not the only ones I've seen. I'm pretty sure Guitar Center has, our musician's friend has one of those like stores that are not their stores selling stuff on Reverb. What I find interesting about the whole Sweetwater having Gear Nuts as their Reverb seller is that Sweetwater has their own used site and that yet they're still selling on Reverb. But I'd have to know what the logic is. You know, the funny thing is it's not something that came up, so it's not something I asked them about. What I will tell you is from my experience with Sweetwater, so is this. Is if I was going to guess, and that's all I can do at this point is guess. If I was going to guess, if I asked the guys at Sweetwater why Gear Nuts is a different name and what is that all about, I'm sure they would be more than have no problem telling me the answer. I've never had Sweetwater. I've never asked a question to the Sweetwater company and them not answer the question direct, you know, with why they do what they do and what they did. Legality wise, I don't think there's any legal issues. I think companies can. DBA is all they want. And what's funny enough is it's not like they're trying to sidestep their warranties and stuff, because I don't think anything negates that from what I read in the Gear Nuts thing. But I guess then at the heart of your question is, I think you asked if it's shady. I don't know. And the reason I say I don't know is because there's a lot of things I think about a lot of this stuff. In other words, like, you know, if you go on DoorDash now and you order some food, sometimes there's ghost kitchens, right? Like Chuck E. Cheese made the news because somebody was ordering pizzas and found out that they were actually being made by Chuck E. Cheese. And like Mr. Beast, I think that's his whole thing, right? You can buy Mr. Beast food on DoorDash, but it's like ghost built by IHOP. So I guess like that, and that's one. So, you know, my understanding is that's one of his ghost kitchens. So if you order food from, you know, on DoorDash and it's like the Mr. Beast food, like one of the kitchens that make it is IHOP or Hidden Valley Inn restaurant or something like that. I don't know. You know, it's a tricky thing. I don't know. Like I said, I just pointed it out a couple weeks ago because, you know, I noticed the Nagels were being sold there as well. Like I said, my biggest problem with it is I don't understand why they even do it. I don't know what the benefit is. To me, the nefarious thing would be if Sweetwater had all kinds of policies in place, and then if you bought on Gear Nuts, you didn't get any like services or anything like that. But I don't get that. I don't get that Gear Nuts is doing anything like sidestepping their quality or anything. Out of all the companies I've ever had to interact with, they are the most, like when you ask them a question, they're just like, they just give you the answer and they go, that's the answer. And you go, somebody says it's probably not the same return policy. I'd have to look. I don't know. But I like that question, and I think we should learn more about it. So, like I said, maybe I'll reach out and ask. Son of John says, hey, Phil, this may be considered a silly question, but why do most of the manufacturers only use a dot or dash on the neck and not have creative artwork like a PRS? It's an expense thing. I mean, that's basically it. You got to understand most of the history of these companies. I mean, look, before CNC machines, inlay work was, this is another whole thing. What Paul was doing, you know, he started in 86 and he had CNC machines probably from the start, well, not from the very start, but from the start of the factory. But I bet you they still were using a pin router or something to do a lot of the inlay work. Now it's not a big deal. Anybody can do any kind of, you know, crazy inlay work. But back in the day, I mean, inlay work was just, you know, it took a skill and it took a lot of time. So a lot of them just did that. And then the kind of the fact that it's now easier doesn't seem to matter. Players just tend to, you know, they like what they like. And in my experience, most players like dots. That, I mean, it's the in like block inlays and stuff. I mean, you'd think that's what everybody wants, but a lot of people do not want the ornate inlay work as much. And that's me, like I said, dealing with people one-on-one, selling guitars. I always thought, like, look at the inlay. And like, whatever, I like dots. I mean, so many people like dots. So that's why I think it's just because, like I said, the heritage of most companies is the expense of it was expensive. Kevin says, for the P90 fund, love my Snark Air. No batteries to replace. Bought based on your recommendation. Yeah, I'm like so happy now that I have clip-on tuners that don't take batteries. The only thing you have to do now is just remember to to charge them, which I'm getting pretty good at. Every once in a while, I grab one and it's dead, and I'm like, ah. So it's nice to have one or two and you always have one charged up. So, yeah, Mr. Mount says, I prefer dots over birds. Somebody says, Bluebird, NC, I prefer dots. A lot of players prefer dots. Not only because they don't like the flash and pizzazz, but a lot of players really rely on the dots to know where they are on the neck. And if you learn on a guitar with dots, all of a sudden when you don't have dots, it really throws you off. Lunamatic says, as a store owner, right? I used to own a store, okay? Don't the brands make you buy all the their brands as part of your order? Yes and no. Regardless of the size of your business, your store, companies, which is really important, like FMIC, Fender Musical Instrument Corporation, companies like FMIC, they have multiple brands. Just because you become a dealer with them or have an account with FMIC does not mean you get access to all the brands. It doesn't even mean you get access to all the Fender products. And that is very common in this industry to compartmentalize many things. So the way it works is the way you probably kind of predict it works. Companies that need your business give you access to everything at a very affordable or very low buy-in rate. So like a company, let's say a company like USF Music Corp. This is a company that doesn't really exist anymore, but they were Washburn Eden at that time, Washburn Eden, Randall, and Parker guitars. They would come to you and the buy-in may be really low. Maybe it's like $5,000. And you can literally cross it across multiple brands. You can go, give me one Parker and give me two Eden amps and a Washburn acoustic, and you just buy in. And as far as anyone's concerned on their website, they would list you as a dealer for all of those brands, whether you're buying all those brands or not, and you have access to anything. So if somebody came to your store and you go, do you have a Randall amp? And like, no, but I could order it for you because they could get it. And that would make sense because obviously those brands were, I don't want to say they weren't premium, but they didn't command much more than that. So if you think about brands like that, it makes total sense. Then you take like somebody like perfect example is Fender, which is a very standard procedure the way Fender operates. So Fender not only would say, okay, specialties, which they call it specialty brands, which at that what currently would now be EVH, Gretsch, Jackson, which it's Jackson Charvel, it's one and the same. Groove Tubes, maybe it's because Sun Amps is back now, Sun Amps, okay. That's what's called specialty. So that's a separate rep, separate account, separate everything, credit line, the whole nine yards. So you could walk into a legitimate Fender dealer with all the Fender brands and they could have access to no specialty brands whatsoever. And they're not a dealer. Specialty brands would sometimes let you crisscross, like you could buy some Gretsch and then maybe a couple of EVHs, and then if you ever have an order for a Jackson, you take it. But a lot of times they would have buy-ins. Fender, so like I said, this FMIC, Fender on itself is like you can be a Squire dealer but not carry Fender. You can be Fender accessories. Think about that. You can carry their accessories, their t-shirts, their mugs, their mouse pads, their strings, picks, but not have access to even Squire, none of their product lines. So think about it. So Squire's a buy-in, then accessories is a separate buy-in. Okay. And those usually they require those every year to be re-upped. In other words, you have to buy into each one of those lines. Then in the Fender lineup, just Fender, Made in Mexico is its own category. So like you can buy Fender Made in Mexico, but you can't buy Made in USA. Then Fender Made in USA. Fender Acoustics is its own category. So if somebody walks in, you could carry, so think of this, you could be a Fender Custom Shop dealer. It's not likely this will happen, but it's possible. You could walk in a store, have Fender Custom Shop, because that's a separate buy-in for that SKU. They could have Fender American, they could have Fender Made in Mexico, they could have Squire, and you go, I want a Fender ukulele, and they can't order it for you because they don't buy into the acoustic line, and the acoustic line ukuleles would fall under that. So they have to separate buy-in for those things, right? Now I said it's possible, not likely, because usually the way it works is that, you know, it's a top-down thing. Once you're buying in the top, you're buying across all the way down. but each one. So not only are those each, do you need those codes to buy from those categories, but like I said, they can require that yearly for you. And companies do that all the time. They have yearly re-ups, all that stuff. Yeah, it can get a little convoluted and crazy. And this is, like I said, at the smaller level, it gets a little more crazier at the bigger level. So to answer your question, that's the answer to your question. As a store owner, do you buy across the brand? Companies like notorious ones are Mason Boogie, but I don't know now because Mason Boogie is owned by Gibson. But back in the day, Mason Boogie, I can tell you why I was never a Mason Boogie dealer. Mason Boogie required $1,500 a buy-in of tubes. And maybe that doesn't sound like a lot of money to you guys, but it's a lot of money for tubes. Because I sold probably $100 worth of tubes a year. You know, people didn't come to my store looking for tubes. So if I would have tubes and somebody come in and going, I had a gig and my tube balloon, do you have any tubes? I'm like, yeah, we got some tubes right there. And you get some tubes, but I didn't carry tubes. So when Mason Boogie's like, you gotta buy $1,500 of tubes, I'm like, well, I just sell $0 in tubes now. How am I gonna go from zero to $1,500 a year in tubes? And they're like, well, if they buy Mason Boogie amps, they're gonna buy the tubes. I'm like, I guess, right? It was a scary thing. So that's how it works with buy-ins with companies. And a lot of the stuff is actually probably worse now and some of it's better now. So that's how that works. So to buy into the brand, you can. And some companies, like I said, if they need you hard enough, they'll let you buy one thing and then tell people you're a dealer. So there you go. It's great. I a funny story. We'll end on this little funny tidbit that happened. I once had a VP for Fender in my store. I was complaining that a dealer had became a Fender accessory dealer. And I was explaining that my issue is that they were only a Fender accessory dealer to tell everybody how bad Fender was. And I said, I don't understand. I said, you do a horrible job at what I just explained to you guys, right? What I just explained to you, I just explained, but most of you probably don't understand that, right? That there's all these buy-ins, all these codes, all this stuff. And so I said, so the store down the road, or not down the road, but the store, you know, the store in town they could sell you picks and strings and t-shirts from Fender, but not Fender product. And he's like, no, I don't think you understand. You know, we want every dealer to have access to something. And I said, yeah. I said, well, why don't you call that dealer and ask them if they carry Fender? I had no idea if this would work, by the way, but I wanted to see what happened. So he literally gets out his cell phone and he calls the store and he says, hi. And he goes, I'm looking for a Fender guitar and you're listed on Fender's website as a Fender dealer. He was playing dumb, right? And they said, oh, we are a Fender dealer. And he goes, oh, you're a Fender dealer? And they're like, yeah. And he goes, okay, so if I want to buy a Made in Mexico or a Fender American Strat, can I come down and get one? And they go, oh, they're not very good. You should buy a Godin, because they were a Godin dealer. And he's like, oh, really? And they're like, oh, yeah. And he goes, what's so bad about them? Like, oh, yeah, everybody knows they're pretty much junk and Godin is the way to go. We're a dealer, but I couldn't in good conscience sell you a Fender. And he gets off the phone and he's like sitting there and I'm like, see, I told you. That's what I told him. I go, see, I told you. They only have your they only sell your accessories so that they get listed on your website to tell people they're a dealer. And then they're side selling all your customers to somebody else. There you go. I don't know why that story is funny. It always made me laugh. I think it was his face. Like his face when he's like, oh, Fender's horrible, huh? By the way, I don't disagree that Godin's a great guitar against the Fender. I didn't disagree with anything they said. I just thought it was funny that they were actually saying it to the VP at Fender. That was kind of funny. All right, on that note, that was funny. That was a good way to end the show. We'll end the show on that note. As always, I want to thank all of you for being the guests this week on the show. Your questions, comments, your interactions, I think is what makes this all amazing every week. Please look for the new studio and some of the new videos, and thank you guys for the support with that. And I guess now we'll just say have a great weekend, and until next week, know your gear.